We are back on the haphazardly scheduled Rhetoric Training for America. I think I'm just going to cut it down to something quick and easy to say, the RTA, Rhetoric Training for America podcast. We're back with Dr. Dave Payne, emeritus, who's now skirting around the world via Nashville, Atlanta, and South Carolina, then on to Portugal and Italy. You guys were in Italy, right?
Last fall, yeah.
Yeah. Those are good combinations, right?
I think so.
Italy and Savannah, like it's you're running the polarities. We're going to talk today about we're about getting close to 100 days of Trump, and it's a wild ride. It's a new landscape. How does rhetoric situate itself in a chaotic landscape? Like, so you were just saying, what do you see as the role of rhetoric in this sort of Trumpian, constantly roiling chaos?
Well, I was saying that I'm not sure I know that the I mean all of it is still there. Certainly, we have a propaganda machine that is more obvious than ever. More, somebody referred on one of the commenters, the dictator that made the trains run not on time or something like that. I mean, it's almost a,
Yeah, I wrote a joke about that too. About like somebody said to me, Mussolini made the trains run on time. I'm like, yeah, and Hitler made sure that the ovens were set at the right temperature. I mean, what's your point?
Anyway, so yeah, I mean the disruption theory is everywhere. We might identify certain words of the day like uncertainty, and chaos would be among them. So how does rhetoric function in that kind of environment? Or maybe that is the rhetorical environment. It's just one thing I think it does, if I had, straining through my thoughts over the last 100 days or whatever, already in place. But since that those are all distractions, that there's another business that we're still not attending to here. So we're talking about tariffs and their disastrous effect, but not looking at, okay, we're set up here to do a number of deals. Who's going to win in those deals? Who profits? The same as with the kind of the Doge chaos and chainsaw, and the drama there seems to me to be circus-like, while we're not paying attention to how much did this person earn, in what deals got cut. When you get the president selling cars on the one, which
So,
ironically is probably the right role.
right. Yeah, that's
I
pretty
mean,
much
the
what he
thing
should be doing.
that really is what you ought to be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean the Dan Rather's column the other day, when he quoted a Turkish proverb. When did you see that? When the Turkish proverb goes, apparently, when a clown moves into the palace, he does not become a king, the palace becomes a circus.
Yeah,
So
perfectly encapsulating everything.
yeah, I thought but once again, it's so apparent and being reported and explicit. It seems like almost, this is no longer a revelation. This is kind of
Right. So
a shrug.
let's kind of pull back to some of the rhetorical basics to see if we can get a little bit of a compass inside of this kind of landscape. Like one thing I've noticed that Americans have no terminology for this. Like they don't understand the terms that are coming at them now, and you're starting to see this play out like with tariffs. You could have probably asked 95% of Americans before any of this happened what the word tariff meant, and they couldn't have told you. They probably still can't tell you, but now we've got this word that's just like bombarding the planet. He unleashed like literally financial bombs everywhere. And what is a tariff? Like, isn't that kind of the first thing that, as a rhetorician, we've got to take care of? Is like, can we own some of these terms so that people can use them operationally? Because right now they can't. They're completely in free
Right.
fall.
Yeah, the public education gap that's a good thing, especially for me, because yesterday I was watching MSNBC, The Endless Rant, and I quit for months, but I had to do it again just to see, take the temperature right to manage my stock account. So, and they're going through like endlessly, and every show kind of goes over the same topics, but a lot of them contained this informational thing about tariffs. I thought, doesn't everybody already know that? But you're right, they don't. And that fits another of my kind of observations, which are reactions, I guess, which was, why is anybody surprised at this? Why they've been talking about these tariffs for 3 months, 4 months at least. The market's been going down for 2 or 3 weeks at least. I guess the only surprise to me was that it wasn't already kind of priced out, that everybody, that there was still all of this reaction to even be had. So I think this feeds your, observation that most people are, not paying that much attention, and they don't have the vocabulary. They're not.
Well, I just think
We're very reactive.
we're floating in this undefined lexicon, and every day Trump adds something new to it, or the right adds something new to it. Suddenly we're talking about Greenland. Nobody in this country has thought about Greenland for a hundred, and like even that kind of stuff, like trade wars, people don't know what that means. So even traditional politics, people were very iffy on the lexicon. But now, in this constantly new, throwing new garbage into the public stream, I think the amount of confusion, just terminological confusion, I look at it, I'm like, that is just a horrible place to watch people try to orient from.
Right. Yeah, and the way we get it, once again, I'm hardly the typical person, but Greenland's a great example. Trump wants to buy Greenland, or then we get a layer of discourse. We're not ruling out taking it militarily. Everyone's kind of go, yeah,
What?
the Danes are reacting, the Icelanders are protesting, JD Vance, who seldom makes appearances, is all of a sudden, out there in a park of whatever, saying, why don't you want to be part of us or something? I don't know. And it's, you have to dig to get why anybody wants Greenland. Because so you think, God, Trump's just nuts. And then apparently now, whether this story is the reason or the logic, or who knows, that actually, should all the ice melt, there's a lot of minerals there that we need that we're not going to get from China, especially now. So there is a sense of some sort to it, I suppose. But that's all after the fact. And it seems to me to be a pattern that, and it could well be the Trumpian rhetoric. And there's a couple of data points here about that just make the splash, create the stir, no matter who it offends, what it does. How much uncertainty or chaos or alarm, outrage it might create, and then let everybody else kind of make it rational. And that's the media is scrambling, kind of making his actions have some sort of sense. And they're doing the same thing with tariffs now. Oh well, okay, he's been talking about tariffs since 1980s, and he really believes this, and okay, the tariffs go back to the 1800s, and they never were. So we're getting this historical
Right.
profile. We're getting these explanations. We're getting these little mini lessons in tariffs and how they don't work. And anyway, that's kind of a process of normalizing, of absorbing this stuff.
Well, and like you said, sense making. Like, but is that our role as rhetoricians? Because what they're doing is constantly, they're not following any of that sort of traditional purpose of public rhetoric. Like, they're using it to, like I said, constantly cause confusion. Constantly cover up for something else, constantly just stay in the media. And we keep reacting with these more traditional rhetorical things of, well, where is the, what's the sense in this? What are they really trying to do? What's the through line? And I'm not sure that that is us adapting to sort of what's become the modern, moment of what rhetoric is, chaotic rhetoric. Like, how do you respond to chaotic rhetoric? By making it make sense? Like, is that the move? Or do you out chaos it, you know?
Well, I think those are certainly options. Those are certainly options. I guess once again, the great danger of that, and I've preached this for many years, that when rhetorical studies takes a speech and then works really hard to show the rationality in it, that we're doing the work of the speaker, right?
Right.
That it is legitimizing all of that. And that I very much noticed that during Reaganism, right? This was clearly, that was us as academics were doing that kind of work of, well, okay, this is clearly emotional. This is clearly, whatever, mediated. This is clearly shallow, blah, blah, blah. But there is a sensible community rationality process, and that is traditional sort of Aristotelian rhetoric of here's how it does its job, right? The sort of community sense-making, community rationalized, rational process of coming to decision-making. Though it does employ emotion, though it does, right? It's not pure
Right.
logic, of course, all that. Yeah, I think we're into a whole new domain here. But in a way, this is kind of getting, the media now. What should rhetorical studies or rhetorical activism do rather than that? But I think that is the great danger of the more we try to provide rational frameworks for saying how this, what's going on here. And you see more, some obvious instances of this that I've sort of bemoaned all along with Trump of everybody imputes this sort of incredible media manipulator profile to him. That he's, he may not be a genius at politics, but he's a genius at whatever, getting people to pay attention, whatever.
Right.
And that seems to me to be a variety of that, that kind of assuming that there is a great rationality to all of this somehow. Yet at the same time, it's working well enough, I guess, to win an election, and but it's
I
not
mean,
the
I
only
think,
thing working.
right, there's going to be other things, there's going to be other evolutions to it. It's not going to stay stable. But think of the call response structure binary that's been set up, like you're saying, between crazy politics and journalists, crazy politics and academics. They say whatever and we make it make sense. And interrupting that call response is sort of what I see as, I don't know, an elevated rhetoric, a rhetoric of the moment. So instead of using these tools, like you said, that are inherited from Aristotle and, rationality and things like that, if you were to program, because this is kind of what I've been working on, a counter rhetoric, an army, a weaponry, an armory of how do you counter this rhetoric? The first thing I would never do is talk about it, what they're saying rationally. Like, so if they tell a crazy story about Greenland, so let's try this. Let's just do narrative conflict instead of breaking down their story and showing why it's wrong, which is a rationality. Just create a counter story and never even mention their story. J.D. Vance is in Greenland because he has a series of male lovers, in Greenland that he's never revealed,
Or
but
couches, as an example.
or and they all have couches, and that's why he's there or whatever. Like just as a lunatic story to counter a lunatic story.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I thought of couches, that Stephen Colbert continues to call that back, and he says, of course it's not true every time he does it.
Right.
And we do this because it's not true, and then everybody laughs, right? So that strikes me as an example of that exact same kind of counter narrative that is out of, right? And it seems to me that what you're talking about, not surprisingly, is the comic function of, right, unraveling that stuff by just displacing it with other kinds of images. Recently, the tariff one of the Trump talking to the penguins because they put tariffs on this
Yeah.
island that only has penguins and no people, and telling them they're taking advantage of America. And anyway,
But making
so
them
it seems to me
look,
that.
so it's an interesting question though, making them look ludicrous with a comic version of what they're doing, a comic counter narrative is one thing, but can you also do it with the dramatic frame? Like they're going to, and they're seeing, you try to see this kind of seeping under the covers, right? They're actually going into Greenland because it has, precious minerals that we do want. So you see a deeper, nefarious, more drama frame motive. And if we could really draw that story out and move that up above their story, then maybe that's the win.
Yeah, but in a world where at least half the people aren't even watching that story or digging hard enough to get to even what is tariffs, in a way that who does that serve, right? As kind of the
Well, you're seeing though the media do this, like they like with the deportations to El Salvador, right? They pick one guy who is deported incorrectly and has an autistic brother and had a tattoo of, autism support, and they decide that was a gang tattoo, and now he's in prison in El Salvador, and so they're trying to rescue a counter narrative and raise that up above their narrative. Oh, like the dystopian gangs are running amok amok in America, and we're getting rid of them. So it becomes this kind of drama, this dystopian drama conflict of narratives. And I think everybody's looking for dramas that are potent enough to poke through their explanation. And when you find like the woman who bleeds out in the parking lot, right, because of the abortion changes. So they're always trying to do that. And I'm not sure if that's powerful enough to counter them either.
Well, okay, we might have to get a finer brushstrokes here, but because it seems to me that what part of what that's part of the circus environment. There's three, at least three rings going at the same time, right? And if we get you to look over there, you're not looking over here. And so in the example of the I guess I was thinking J.D. Vance making an argument about, oh, this guy, a counter argument that this guy, the guy that was taken to El Salvador inappropriately, he's not. He has a couple of traffic citations, and he's not Father of the Year. Once again, we've already gone down the rabbit hole of that example. Another one was, back in the election with the. A great absurd one on their part, the Haitians eating pets. And a week and a half later, we're debating, so the news media thinks it's doing a great job of coming saying this really isn't going on, but if it really were going on, and who are these Haitians? And and then once again, they love that fight.
Well,
They
it
took that
stays on
fight
their
on.
rhetorical ground, right? It stays in their story.
And even the voice said, "Well, what if it isn't true? That doesn't matter. We do stories that aren't true all the time." So, once again, it seemed to me that they win that one, no matter what we try to dis what narrative is sane narrative tries to displace it,
Right, but again, like, are we fight?
or
We
their
don't need to
audience.
fight. We don't need to fight with sane narratives, is my point. Like,
Well, that's a different point.
we can create just as insane narratives as they are, if that's the game now. Where, so if you look at rhetoric going away from logos and rationality and truth telling and truth seeking over to just fantasticalism, who can tell the most fantastic story, that gets the most attention and the most, imagination? That's a different, it's a different ball game.
Right. Well, it gets back to the re reality-based community kind of problem. Do they really want that? I mean, and you're right. I think the just oh, it's not true. It's not true. A fact-checking thing is right. Spinning
It's
your wheel.
useless.
But I'm not sure the other side, the counter, really wants that same kind of narrative. There's got to be some sort of distinction in there somewhere.
Yeah, I know.
Whether it will work or not, oh boy, that's you're right. The tools of truth are challenged here, and that is precisely the point.
Yes,
The truth
I'm trying to
industries
stretch our
are not.
open up our armory to some
I mean,
new.
as academic, the truth industry is important to me, but and I think to the liberal progressive agenda, the truth based and the science based, all of that. So, I mean, how do you count? I don't know. I'm finding around a lot just recently. Every time climate change come up, or you complain about it's hot, or say, why did you leave Florida? Look, it's been hot, and I'm hearing the answer. Well, there is climate change. It's called weather. are it changes all the time, of course. There seems to be an obligation on their part to deny the science of this, even if it's not directly in the conversation. So anyway,
We'll take that one again as we look for our new armory as rhetoricians. We now understand that human brains are very programmable, right? And especially with screens 3 inches from your face, social media coming at you all the time, cable media, and fed by a crazy dystopian propaganda machine, very, very powerful neurological changes, so that people will now regurgitate script no matter what it is. And so you're seeing this like with Canada. Like if you, there was a graph I saw yesterday online that showed here's been the way America sees Canada, the GOP sees Canada for the last 100 years. And now look at the trending upwards of how negative they're starting to see Canada. And you're like, okay, so basically anything that steps into the narrative of that's a villain, no matter who it is or what it is or anything else, they can get traction.
No, the massive group psychosis is, I mean, yeah, it's very clear. You're if you're not on our side, you're against us, and you're the enemy. And that clearly is working. I mean, that divisiveness, polarity, and we've known that all along, but the fine graining on that is getting amazing. And how quickly their media culture disseminates and aligns. And once again, talk about the tragedy of the Biden presidency is the belief that one can sort of change that and not be, polarized and divisive.
Right. Well, it's using again that sort of traditional valorization of the rational and the civil, and the communal and all the stuff, that Biden was good at
The
talking.
transcendence of rhetoric. Yes, that, yes,
Yes.
absolutely.
Versus what has become, a vitriolic, I call it vitriolic gibberish the other day. Just this sort of hyper slander machine, hyper villainy machine, dystopian fiction. Right, so it's just bazooking mortar shots into the rational civil all day long, and the rational civil isn't really defending itself. Can it defend itself is, I guess, the question. Like, if you have no guardrails on what kind of rhetoric can be thrown into your public discourse, and now 60-70% of it is this dystopian fiction. And we're seeing us shrink further and further with the civil rationals. What do you do? Do you ex you go back into this and expand it? Do you make that more vivid? Do you make people understand that sort of civility and rationality has this hyper value? Like, I'm watching Gavin Newsom. Have you seen his podcast at all?
I have not.
So Governor of California has now got a podcast, and he had Steve Bannon on. And he had one of the other, Charlie Kirk. And he basically, because he was being civil as the podcast host, let them blare their bullshit, full speed and full bullhorn on his podcast. And he would counter it a little bit here and there, but under the guise of, hey, we're trying to understand and maybe we can meet in the middle on things. I'm like, and he took a lot of heat from the left for that. So is, as you look for strategies and tactics to counter their dystopian fiction machine, that's what I'm sort of interested in right now, is like, well, do we counter it with a utopian fiction machine? Or do we go and show that people, hey, these are flawed, this is a flawed logic and flawed truth, and therefore you should dispel and just, forget about the entire dystopian fiction totally. And that's, people don't seem willing to do that.
Well, I think it's provocative to suggest that, a utopian fiction might work. I think, yeah, put a star by it and pull it over to to the edge of the column here, that we want to return to that. What would that look like, and how does it function in this ecology? What I would observe as a student of the history of all of this, they have a lot of history on their side. The tragic frame of rejection here of, this goes back to primitive magic and tribal,
Right.
society, right? It doesn't have to make sense, but it works to organize people, right? Oh, somebody's sick. Well, must have been some sort of crime. What are we going to do is go and kill the other tribe. Anyway, it works
Right.
every time. So let's say that the history of that
It's great to have a
and the
villain.
history of that and when that comes out. I mean, this is to me in terms of the rhetorical frame, not to get too far away from that, because I think we won't, do want to come back to that remedy and its possibilities. But the frame to me that is not ever challenged here is how fundamental this reflex, this totalitarian, authoritarian purification impulse really is, that this is a kind of a fundamentalism. Once again, even the I think that what I don't hear being said about the tariff moment, or the clean out, you had some version of this with McCarthyism. This parallels what was happening in Germany in 1930s very closely, that there is this kind of distrust of the traditional liberal progressive agendas, a return to some kind of basics. And right now, the kind of and I'm only beginning to try to sort out how much of this is Project 2025 or just kind of a cloth with it. There's certainly nothing, it seems to be contradictory between Project 2025 and wreck the stock market, but
Right.
as a step to get there, create a lot of uncertainty and disorientation, because
Sure.
the order that will be rebuilt is what ceases. But if you get back to the kind of the rhetorical genesis or birth of, I see Trump and Trumpism as a kind of mutation of Tea Party, and that is a kind of mutation of Reaganism. And there's always been this kind of get back to basics, get back to basics. So in 2008, I think was a cusp moment, that a good part of the people thought we should just let the economy collapse. It's a fake economy, and bolstered by debt, and yada yada yada. And the only way to really set it right again, get it on the right, to what is the myth of and utopia of rational markets, free markets that will take care of all these problems by themselves, is let it go ahead and die out. And of course, what happened was the Democrats and the Republicans both said, no, you can't really do that. We've studied the Great Depression. That'll take 20 years and maybe a world war. We don't want to do that. But that undercurrent of distrust and people, the libertarian movement, seeing Republicans and Democrats, traditional Republicans and Democrats, as basically the same, right? And on the left, you heard that decrying of that as neoliberalism. So even the far left and the far right were kind of in agreement, or at least they were fighting this complete polarity over the heads of those in the middle. So in a way, this is just consummating that same kind of fundamentalism of, if we get back to basics, it's going to heal itself. And on his way to the golf course yesterday, Trump said essentially that, oh, this is going well. This is all good. It's a great time to get rich. Join me. This is so. The question is, are you on board with that, or are you kind of going, oh man? So
Well, it's
I'm sorry for
breaking the piggy
that
banks
sort of.
again. It's running through the middle class, breaking the piggy banks again. Which is what they did with the real estate, swindle. It's what they did with the tech stock swindle. It's like just run through the middle class, break their banks, steal their money, and keep running, and watch them go. What happened? How did I didn't see this. Where did they come from? Where did
This
these
whole thing, but bring back manufacturing.
neo-barbarians come from?
Yeah, I don't know about your kids, but mine didn't grow up really wanting to work in factories. So this whole bring back manufacturing as the promise of America, at the same time banning immigrants, right? How to work in them? How does that work exactly? And so I think once again, if you look at what if you buy the economic analysis that the tariffs will increase the average family's expenses somewhere between $2,500 and $5,000 a year that they're going to be spending on their goods, but eventually make sure that we have to that we manufacture them here ourselves, what you've created is a whole new working class, right? You slap down the middle class into the lower class at the same and in the same day that you propose tax cuts for the rich, slashing tax cuts that will be paid for by these same $2,500 to $5,000 taxes on the lower class. So
Right. So,
it's not a mystery.
Right. Can we make that financial story vivid enough? Remember, like the Big Short, they struggled
Oh
so
yeah,
hard
absolutely.
in the Big Short to narrativize that, to turn
Yeah.
into characters, turn into
Yeah, Margot
followable plot.
Robbie and Anthony Bourdain, those were beautiful little, I thought of that the other day. I really did, exactly.
Yeah, so much.
These little educational moments about how the market works.
So how do we do that? Like again, rhetorically, simple narratives, which is tr one of Trump's fortes, the simple narrative of, hey, there's a villain. They're a bad villain. They're a really scary villain. Watch out for that villain. I'm going to do something about that villain. That story structure seems to work pretty well. When you pick a villain like that, and then everybody can kind of understand it. Even looking at Canada, like, my God, what a coward. Like, he won't go after Russia, he won't go directly after China, but he'll go after Canada, and like, there you go, there's a villain I can handle. And you see this kind of stuff, but it's simple narrative versus like the financial narrative is incredibly complicated. And it goes back to this idea that America is now dealing with trying to understand things that they've never had to understand before. Tariffs are a good example. That's a financial phenomenon. It's a financial tool or weapon that Americans don't understand. We've never lived under that system where it's obvious to us all the time that tariffs are part of life, even though they've been around, but not as this kind of sort of front of show weaponry. And so, are we going to get caught up in this idea of our narratives are too complex, to get followers? And they're going simple narratives as a superstructure. Like, then we have to figure that out.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, I mean, all of this was apparent and overt in the campaign. These just did not dominate. The more simple ones did. I think that is what they did. In other words, which ones are going to survive? Talk about, trans kids in sports is that sort of thing. These are the moments, both positive and negative. About one's opponent or whatever. So I think it did, people, everybody could have asked, and many did, about the whole thing about tariffs 4, 5, 6 months ago. And all at least those who are paying attention, right? But that didn't, so now everybody's going, wow, what are you doing? In the Republican Party, they just didn't think that was the important salient set of issues. And so that is how the political drama, that something that more is at stake. So, what were the defining things? Inflation, right? And immigration and the culture war, right? Wokeism and transgenderism. So those were the things, those were the narratives from there, the simple narratives where we know what good and evil is. That made all the rest of this conversation about the economic plan and corruption and Trump's crimes and all of that completely not be the deciding moments. It simply displaced consciousness. People would have to work too hard to get the economic narrative.
Right. So then, what do the Democrats do? What do liberals do as a counter narrative strategy? Like, what are the simple stories that we have that are potent enough to compete with their simple stories of, these hyper
Well, I
villains in
can
the
tell you
world?
what they did. I mean, you want to talk about anecdoting that with, or opposing that with utopian narratives. I mean, the progressive narrative is a utopian narrative. That's what progress is a utopian
Sure.
narrative. And so diversity, equality, social justice, those are the utopian evolutions of society. And in a way, if you read historians, we've kind of been in the struggle with progressive reform and versus backward-looking conservatism since the beginning.
Right, for sure.
And just as we have been in a struggle between oligarchy of the South and democracy as narratives right from the very beginning. The Civil War was fought over it. And so that tension has the back and forth of that. So the whole democratic, we're going to preserve the democracy became the rant or the chant, I guess, was to be both of the campaign. That is a utopian narrative. That, and it still is yet today that we need to preserve democracy.
Right. Well, democracy itself is the idea of a utopian political system.
Right. And you're buying into some of those when you say you want the average person to understand the economics of what's going on, or at least what it spells for them.
I didn't
That
say that. I just said they don't.
well, true. But you're sort of asking, how can we get them to? And that is part of
I'm
the
saying is, how can we get them a story that energizes their vote? I don't
or
care if
obviates
it's
all of that, right?
Santa Claus. I just
Well, I
want to
think
turn out.
the good and evil story on the other side is but once again, it may well be that at any point in time those two things have a kind of an equilibrium in this culture and this society. And part of the reason why we're talking about an election that was won by less than 1% of the votes, and an election in which 18% of the voters didn't, that voted in the previous election, but not this one, right? So,
But isn't it the job
in
of
a
the
way,
rhetorician?
these things are at a kind of a stalemate, and the real deciding factors are things like, race and gender.
Right. But isn't the job of the rhetorician to look at the balance, the thing barely balanced, and just keep putting things on the side that you want to win, right? Keep taking things away from the other side so that they have less and less gravitas, less and less effect. And I'm surprised. And I saw some of the, where people were starting to get tired of the Trump rhetoric. There are times when it flags, but there's always so many villains, so many things that they can villainize that they can re-energize it at some point. Like you were talking about the woke stuff. And I remember when the Olympics came through and the woman from, was it Afghanistan, who they said had too much, testosterone, and they were claiming she was trans because she was too strong. And that suddenly, like, they're just going around, and just every day there's these corrals of villains that they can go through, and they wait for one to flame up in pop culture that has enough reach, put it into their rhetoric, and that just keeps flaming the machine. And
Okay,
the left doesn't
so
seem to
now that
have
I
that.
historicized, sure. Now that I historicized and big pictured it, what you're talking about, right? Why doesn't the other side have a? Can't they populate the media sphere with the same kinds of just random stuff?
Or
I
no
mean, if you think about
heroes.
QAnon and the Russian trolls and all of those things are exactly what you're talking about. That's all they do is populate and disseminate. It's just strings of nonsensical,
If they can
hair-pulling
put any
stuff.
negative charge on anything, they'll amplify it.
Right. Or if you have a judge that votes against your way, then you just populate the world with all this other stuff, about how they're, biased, yada 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 yada, and are Haitians are eating dogs and on and on and on. And so yeah, that is exactly what they're doing. I suppose there is a liberal, and I do hear echoes of it. There is a liberal version of that out there of online woke progressive folks that have what I consider to be, fairly alarmist and spurious stories that are disseminated quickly. It doesn't have, the struggle is for the middle here, and it's not getting into the right. So look at a political world, once again, all this talk about partyism when both parties only have about 30% of the voters, and the independents, the non-party align. So you can't even claim a victory as being a victory for a party or its agenda. It's really something about something completely else. It's another sorting that's going on here. And I think that's the thing that the myth of the past that
Well, let me ask you about
need to
this.
move past.
So if the right has signed off on the villainy strategy, find villains, amplify them, distribute them, that's their big thing. Can the left counter that with the hero strategy?
Well, that they've tried to do that, right?
I've seen them do like AOC, right, coming up, during
Absolutely.
the immigration stuff and getting some airplay and things like that. Bernie Sanders suddenly is back up on the dais,
Well, they tried to do that with Kamala, yeah.
Yeah, she could not absorb enough hero, apparently. They did definitely try to heroin her. Like, they definitely even the way they talked about her, and she came out of nowhere. I'm not sure she fits the traditional American, monomyth story well enough to excite
Sure.
that.
Yeah. There's, I mean, look, it's a different conversation than one that's probably already been had, but we've not yet, in terms of leadership, completely got over the gender thing. And right.
Oh, for
That's.
sure. That's why I look at Gavin Newsom, and I would consider him to probably be the front runner for 2028. He's the only guy that visually kind of fits it. And he's a straight white male, which is
Josh
what
Shapiro.
Shapiro a little bit, but Shapiro looks kind of nerdy. You know,
Well, I
he
don't
does not
know.
a, doesn't have a hero look.
He talks good. He talks good. I think he can be a rhetorical hero.
He has some good moments.
The guy out of Illinois, the governor
Yeah,
there
but
is.
he looks like Fred Flintstone.
Well, maybe.
Now the question is like media hero versus rhetorical hero. And
Sure,
Newsom is well
sure.
spoken. Like he's got a lot of assets. I'm just wondering, like, does his are his liabilities, because he's so DEI focused, so he's been the mayor of San Francisco, he's got such a legacy with progressivism. Is that going to be impossible for him to overcome?
That certainly is the question. That certainly is the question. No, I think you're right that finding the person to cast as the rhetorical hero here is, and then somebody that also has the seeds of their leadership role that they can step into. I mean, we do the work on them to turn them into a leader, but there's got to be a charismatic foot in the door
Well, look at
to get
Biden.
people.
I
I
mean,
mean, look at transforming Trump into the leader. What an amazing feat that is, right?
right. It doesn't matter who, as long as they are willing to run the rhetoric and what and stand there in a blue suit and a red tie, it seems to be enough. But like, if you look like Biden, the heroic side of Biden, the 50 years, the poorest member of Congress, the dead wife and children, all the things, and then his son, he had a bunch of hero in him, and he'd been around for a long time, so it was hard for them to stain him right away. And but once he got into the presidency, the stain machine started and kind of started pulling him down out of the hero status, whatever way they could. But so like, if our goal as progressive rhetoricians, if we're on the side of the progressives, to create a new hero that is more impervious to their shit staining, like how do we do that? Like how do we amplify this lefty hero?
I think attention to it. I think once again, I think the biggest liability on the part of the Democrats slash progressives is they don't really want to do this. They don't really want to walk around politicized. They don't really want to pay attention. They just want to be right. And so the messaging did not occur. I mean, no, everybody was happy to let Biden do it and heroize him and be done with it and fight the battle day to day, tit for tat about. Yes, he is. Yes, he's doing great things. No, he is not. He's not. And so, and then sort of throw it up in the air at the end. When it came time to choose a candidate for the next election, the Democrats still couldn't say, or Biden couldn't say, "Gee, here's somebody who stands a chance of beating Trump." And so
Right.
the belief was, if we don't go with Biden, we got nobody. And they, in those 4 years, they did absolutely nothing to front stage Harris. Nothing.
Nothing.
Or to answer any of the
They did no hero building
suggested
whatsoever.
negatives about her. And so the moment she became the possibility, the narrative about her on the other side was absolutely in place already. She's a DEA hire. She slept with somebody, and all of that stuff could, that's all, it's just all garbage. It could have easily been. And she did a pretty good job of kind of stepping beyond all of that. But once again, it was too little too late. And
You don't create a hero that fast.
Furthermore, all of the negatives about what Biden was doing, and once again, when you've got a schismogenic media environment where there's not any crossover, I mean, once again, one side's only watching Fox News 24 hours a day, they're not going to get the other narrative. Clearly,
Right.
the people were doing the work on those on MSNBC and others to answer those kinds of things, but. And that, to me, the selectivity of media is the biggest problem. They're
Well,
simply not going to get exposed.
One thing that about MSNBC, though, and I think this is one of the differences in the right-wing media and the left-wing media, just thinking again in terms of heroes and villains, because I'm trying to get people, when I do rhetoric training, political training with people, I try to start with really super strong but super simple rhetorical concepts, because nobody is used to thinking about the backstage tactical structure and strategy of these things. So if the left is needs to build heroes in order to win, and the right needs to find villains in order to win, like they've got their hero. Like Trump has clearly ascended to hero status. They're trying to put him on Mount Rushmore, trying to put him on the $19 bill, whatever they're doing. I saw the other day they're trying to rename District of Columbia like District of Trump or something. And so they've got their hero, and that's good enough for people. Even it doesn't matter whether it's true. The evangels can hold him as up as a hero, and they've got their villains, DEI. Like my God, I thought, they kept cycling through until they found some kind of replacement terminology for race that they could just say with absolutely no repercussions. It turns out it's an acronym. Like they couldn't say Black Lives Matter because it had the word black in it. They couldn't say Project. What was the thing in the black education thing that they had for a while as a demon? But DEI is perfect. It has no baggage, right?
Right.
And so they can pour as much derision and venom as they want into that. So as I've seen, like the right gain rhetorical assets for its strategy. I haven't seen the left, counter that and say, well, we need to build up heroes. Let's figure out how to do that. Because they keep trying to build up with fairness, like somebody who takes care of everybody. Like Kamala Harris even said this, I'm going to be the president for everybody. Like, yeah, everybody doesn't want you. They don't, you're not really the president for everybody. You're the president for liberals, rationals, and nice people.
Absolutely. For the last, during the whole Trump thing and beyond, even during the Biden years, the educated liberal mantra and ethos was, "Oh, we've got to reach out and talk to and understand the other side." You didn't hear that talk on the other side.
No.
Oh, we do understand them. They're wrong, right? And not just wrong, but dangerous. They are what's wrong. So that rhetoric of vilification. And that's been going on since the mid-80s. That's been going on. I mean, Newt Gingrich was one of the pioneers of wrote a pamphlet on how to do exactly that sort of discourse. So yeah, they started 40 years ago turning liberal into a dirty word.
Well, and you were
So
asking how they're going to man the manufacturing without immigrants. I think they're just going to start having liberal camps.
well. Could be. That's his goal for the liberals, and maybe for African Americans, right? Minorities.
Well, and I
Could well
also thought
be.
about this for the left, like before the coalition of the disenfranchised was women and blacks was the core during the civil rights and women's movement and things like that. But now it's seeded down into this very, very small groups like trans. That's a very, very tiny population. And you're seeing, I mean, the amount of defense that the left has had to play for that tiny, tiny population is just undefensible. Like, there's no way to win defending that tiny population because it's not a coalition of enough voters. So when you look at these kind of things, you're like, well, as they splinter the coalition on the left down into its tiny things and find their villains over there, they take away all this energy for like constantly talking about the middle class and women's rights and that kind of stuff. And so it seems like it runs, you only have so much rhetorical gas every day, and it's being spent on trans issues.
Well, that's right. The flip side is the absolutism of right, and so that comes to a head in one of these moments defending the controversy about two kids in Montana, two trans kids right on the wrong team, people who used to be boys are playing on the girls' team. And this, you don't want to decide all of our national policy on the basis of this particular conflict, but the utopianism and idealism and absolutism on the side of the progressives looks that way from the other side. They can hold that up as the extreme case of you've taken us down to places that don't make any sense and they violate the laws of God, and and so that makes it easy. That's fun. So, when you ask how do you where they know how to find their hero or their villains, they don't have to do that work. We will do that for them, because every time you try to turn somebody into a hero, that will become instant villain on the other side. If you
So
don't have any
again,
moorings in fairness or rationality, you've got a lot of interpretive.
right. So again, then, is still the only path to victory for progressives in current America a white male of substance, that is kind of unassailable. If you look all the way back to Clinton and Carter and all these guys, it seems to be. You've got to start with that as the hero frame, instead of saying, well, that's wrong, and losing again and again and again. We're not ready yet for female. We're not ready yet for, especially female minority. Do you want Trump, these people to win forever by running white men? What's our play?
Well, but just look at the machine that produced on the other side. Pete Buttigieg debating his run for the presidency. He's a great guy,
He'd be a great
rhetorically
president, a
incredible,
great
be a
progressive
great
president.
president. But you try that one, right?
Yeah, it'll never work.
And Kamala coming out in the last 3 or 4 days with this whole shakeup, saying I'm not going anywhere. So she has, for the first time, stepped out of the wings here.
Dude, I don't need to hear from her anymore.
You will. And once again, the heroizing of her through the previous election means that she's probably got a really strong start.
Well, it's just again, rhetorically, look, just take away all the morality of it, the justice for of it, and everything else. But as rhetoricians, if you said, hey, you're going to go up against this in 2028, here's the machine that you're going up against. You've got to counter program against that machine, and we're going to give you this candidate. I'd be like, well, I'm quitting. I'm going to move to the another. I'm not going to do this kind of work anymore because you're guaranteeing me failure. And I'm not saying that to me, as you lay out rhetorical goals, the first one is win the presidency, win the Senate, win the fucking House, regardless of
I think
ideology.
I we hear that comment. We have to focus on winning elections, right? And that is a kind of a once again, when one seeks moral purification and personal purification by being right and voting the right way, and once again, that gets back to these footprints were all there in the abolitionist movement, right? That same kind of the reform
Sure.
movement in America is, that deep. And so that's been there. That is one of the features or of the utopian rhetoric. So anyway, there's a tiny silver lining is that without Trump, will their hero generating?
Right. Who do they have?
To me, it's almost more like the being there, the Chauncey Gardner kind of just. An accidental thing that they were able to turn him into what they have. I see nobody waiting in the wings to take up that mantle. But maybe this is, Dan, just the game of history being played out over and over again. That you talked about
You
Clinton. You
have become a historian. You are
well,
not a
you almost have
rhetorician
to. Well, I guess when
anymore.
you get
You're not
old
even a
enough, you almost
rhetorician
have to, right?
anymore. You're a historian.
I think they're very closely related, actually.
They are very closely related, but I had this discussion with Hart, back when I had him on the podcast, and at one point he finally was like, well, everybody's overreacting. These forces of conservatism and liberalism are always going back and forth in America, and we always overreact. And I'm like, yes, except there are new factors playing in the world that have never existed before. You know, social media, cable media, and AI and things like this have never existed before. There is no gatekeeper, you know, for the American mind anymore. Not even nothing. And the left, the right has never had that access before, ever. You know, so it to me, like, yes, historical forces, but we have a new technology and we have a new environment, new ecology going on. And if we don't look at that, then, you know, I think it's
And
a
I think we want to sum up and pull forward those things that you're talking about. Absolutely. That playing with new media and using new media and the sociology of new media are very much things that the Republicans have excelled with. And it matters a lot. Now, the results of having that as the only game board are something that as we got to stop and consider. That doesn't mean yeah, the
Yeah, it doesn't
funny
mean history
moment,
has stopped. I get it. Yeah,
fun,
it's.
funny funny moment when Cory Booker did his 25-hour historical. Somebody made the joke. It was Dick Durbin or somebody who said, "Yeah," or a White House, I guess it was, who said, "Yeah, yesterday we got him on TikTok because he'd already gotten 350 million likes on TikTok, but the day before he did not have a TikTok account." So talk about late to the
Right.
show, right? Late to the
Yeah.
show.
Oh, it's amazing to me, like how little, you know, they've engaged with that side of the world. Even watching Gavin Newsom try to do podcasting, and I think he's clunky at it. He's a good communicator, but I'm like, you don't understand the medium that you're in. Like, you're allowing these people, you know, laterality, and you don't have to do that. Like, he thinks he has to do it to get them on there. Because I've worked in the media for a long time. Like, when I worked at Best Damn Sports Show, they told us we couldn't make fun of athletes, you know, because they wouldn't be come on the show as guests.
Right.
I'm like, so like when Pete Rose came out and admitted he bet on baseball, the entire world was telling jokes, Pete Rose jokes, and we had him on the show that day, and we couldn't do jokes about him. I'm like, we're the comedy sports show, you know? So there's always restrictions for that stuff, and you got to really understand kind of the mediums that you're working in. And I don't see that kind of deafness, you know, on the left yet. It's definitely on the right. The right, you know, programmed this early. They funded it early back in the 80s, like you said. And so they've built infrastructure for it. But we as rhetoricians kind of look at it and go, yeah, I see your infrastructure. Like, I
Well,
can see the
harnessing
definitions
the
of it.
energy of conspiracy is, I mean, because it is self-organizing. The you know, and they all refer back to, very sources. So all these people out there thinking they're doing their own research are looking at things that are generated by two or three sources at best, but
Right.
it's exfoliated, right, into all these places where they think they're finding it in their original the high participation. So it is also that you've got to be high participation. Once again, how, you know, once again, there's class and other things operating that this particular group, it, right, the number of people on the left doing that or wanting to do that, or the number of people in the middle having time to do that, right?
Right.
People with jobs and families that occupy
Well,
the middle here. But anyway.
On this idea that you know, we need a hero, you know, and Cory Booker suddenly, you know, having a 24-hour news cycle about him, you know, because he stood up and talked for 25 straight hours, like, wow, the criteria for being a hero is pretty small. You don't go to the bathroom for 24 hours or 25 hours. And
Well,
I'm
but
not a.
that's classic martyrdom and sacrifice. It's in
There you go.
there you go. Yeah,
But, you
certainly.
know, they set him up against the ultimate villain of Strom Thurmond, the racist. You know, so there was all sorts of narrative elements going on. Will that ascend him to a level of, I don't see him being able to beat Trump or the next, you know, the Trumpalite coming along afterwards that. There's something like Cory Booker that doesn't work for me as a performer. But I think that's, to
Kind
me,
of
like maybe.
wild-eyed at the end of it. I mean,
He's always like
there's,
that. His
yeah.
he needs performance coaching. Like, he needs a really good director because there's something off in the way he delivers that makes him look crazy. But you would think, like, what the Democrats need to be doing right now is three words, and that's it. We need a hero. That's all they need to be thinking about, you know? So find one because
I
I don't.
suppose that will take many, many forms of we need a candidate. We need a
I just because I don't. You got to get something.
Well, you
Well.
very appropriately kind of stopped my moment in the tracks about history that for the moment, right, they produce, it was Reagan was unpredictable. Bush Jr. almost completely unpredictable. I mean, and maybe didn't, who knows whether he won the election or not. But certainly by the end of it, he was, and sort of set the stage for Obama, I guess. But and Trump was unpredictable. But I'm saying on the other side, the people that you mentioned coming forward that have succeeded, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, they were also pretty unpredictable, they started their campaigns as nobody, and they just found their historical moment. So I think the thing is, and maybe the left needs to be cautioned of, or many of them need to be, that this doesn't have to be an institutional person. And what's true of all of those people is none of them were out of Congress. The Dems keep wanting to run senators, and that's almost the kiss of death.
Right.
And Obama's, there are very few examples of senators that actually win. Obama was one, but he was only there for a short while, and he was different in so many other ways. He had
Yeah.
not really become an institutional character.
Well, you saw with like the Carter and Clinton Southerners who were acceptable to the Midwest and the coasts, so they had enough Southernness to be somewhat acceptable to the South.
Right.
And that kind of educated Southerner, if you play it correctly, and both of them played the aw shucksism of it forever, maybe the political hero that you have to amalgamize still, because we still have to deal with the fact that this big block of the South has now metabolized, it's metastasized out into other places, and it has its little pockets voting. Taking over Montana and all the sort of outlying states to get enough energy to elect people. So I don't know, like maybe that's what I'll name this episode, We Need a Hero, because I think that is the rhetorical gong that I'm going to hit for the Democrats for the next 3.5 years. Forget Trump, he's going to screw everything up and try to run again. The only way he's going to get out of there is if he dies. I can't see him ever leaving ever again because he's realizes he doesn't have to.
Well, he may be losing the business community. I mean, money is power, and I think they elected him. I think they can unelect him.
I don't know,
I
man.
think.
Everybody who's tried to step in front of the Trump train and be like, hey, I said not to do this, he just runs right over him. There does not seem to be a day of reckoning for that guy.
That's so far.
So far.
So far.
All right, well, this is super fun. I'm gonna, like I said, try to get going again on the podcast. I'm gonna get to a new place and set up a dedicated space. So, super fun. Yeah. So, any ideas you have about We Need a Hero or winning the
I'll give
narrative
it some
war?
thought. I'll give it some thought about how we make heroes.
Yeah, that would be a good one. We'll
Well,
send it as a template.
it echoes one of the first things I ran into in grad school, the Parson Weems, the making of, right, a myth, George Washington, the making of a myth, right? So that here we have this new country, we just look around, okay, we got a general, let's turn him into,
Yeah, tall white
and
guy. Here we go.
there was an active, so yeah, this is a, or how do you take Abe Lincoln and turn him into, So,
Yeah, an angel on earth. All right, well, I'll come back around. Thanks, Dave. We'll catch you
hey, good
next
to
time.
see you.
You too.
Bye now.